Good afternoon, everyone. So, last time we talked a bunch about various things in C, talked about more about how arrays and pointers relate in C, how they're different, not. We talked about a bunch of miscellaneous things in C, either that were different than C++, or were things that are in C++ that you've never seen that will went in this course, like go to. And we also talked about how structs in C work, since this, you know, they're kind of like classes, but they're different in some significant ways that you'll notice if you ever try to write or read any C code. And we talked about C standards, about how what is C is defined, and this notion of undefined behavior, where the standard doesn't say what to do in certain cases, and compilers take advantage of that rather than choosing just one option. They do whatever they like, depending on possibly how you compile the program or many other things. And this is how C deals with things like out-of-bounds array accesses and other things that you might be used to always crashing or always wrapping around in the case of integer arithmetic and so on. So any questions about any of the things we talked about last time before I move on? Okay, so everyone seems good for now. So a brief logistical note. So labs, I may have not made this clear enough, are generally due around the end of the lab day. We'll say sometime after 11 p.m. they're due. It's sufficiently after 11 p.m. that you shouldn't have problems because your clock isn't synced or because you can't get to the submission site fast enough, but. And homework is generally due the week following the corresponding lab at noon. It's on a Wednesday. Okay. And I had this slide up on some lists in C. So we showed, when I was talking about malloc and free, various ways of doing linked lists, which you've hopefully seen before, and ways of doing something like what you might be used to as a vector in C++, how you implement that in C, this range structure here. And there's the another option we talked about when we talked about strings, which is where you have a dynamic array where you know how big it is because it has some sentinel value at the end. In the case of strings, we use \0, but you could imagine using any value you don't expect in the list. So in this case, we hope that no one cares about storing the number -9999. And we'll have a homework that will refresh you on dealing with these, and in particular, make sure you actually know how to use pointers in C a few weeks from now. And as an additional addendum to what we talked about last time, we talked a bit about structs. And I said structs were basically classes from C++ without methods. And one thing I should have made clearer is that C++ has objects work a bit differently than Java, and you might not remember this clearly. In particular, they aren't references. So in Java, you have every object is a reference. When you pass it to a function, you're passing a reference. This is not how structs work in C, not how classes work in C++. So if you have here a local variable bar declared, then it's an instance. It has its own storage. In particular, since it's a local variable, it's probably on the stack. So it's stored on the stack along with our return address and save registers and so on. It's not a reference. There's no, it's not stored on the heap. So any questions about this? Yeah.
Does triple bar equal foo actually do a copy operation?
So the question is, does bar equal foo actually do a copy operation? Yes. So in C, when you assign one struct to another, it copies each element one at a time, as if you assigned each element independently. Which means it doesn't copy what pointers point to, but it copies the pointers, and so on. So for the rest of the day, unless there are questions on C, which I will be glad to answer now, we'll be talking about assembly and do a combination of a refresher and talking about some stuff in assembly that's new in this course, most notably different syntax. Okay. So let's start out with the syntax. So our textbook and various tools we'll be using use the AT&T syntax for x86 assembly, which is not what you all probably saw in 2150. So let me show you an example of something in Intel syntax, an AT&T syntax, which shows the big differences. So we have for the AT&T syntax, this is moving the number 42 to memory at a location specified by a register. In AT&T syntax, the location goes second, not first. We have to put this funny dollar sign in front of the number. We put parentheses around the value instead of writing something like pointer or putting square brackets. But this is exactly the same instruction. And sort of our one slide summary of most of what you need to know for AT&T versus Intel syntax is the destination is always last. So always, even in cases where you might think you wouldn't really do that, it's always last. You can think of it as that you can think of as you draw. Draw an arrow. Yeah, here we are. Oh. You think of it that you draw an arrow. I should use a physical color. Draw an arrow this way, if you want to remember that. That's so, want to remember what the effect of any instruction is.
Is that 42 hex or 42 decimal?
That's 42 in decimal. So, the question is, was it hex or decimal? That's 42 in decimal. In AT&T syntax, we will use 0x to represent hexadecimal. There's no implicit values are hexadecimal. Okay, so the destination's always last, and any time we represent a value in memory, we use parentheses. So the parentheses mean get this from memory, not from the location directly. So that's storing in memory, not accessing RBX to store something in it. Constants always are going to start with dollar signs. Registers are always going to start with percent signs. And we have this weird postfix on the instruction. In this case, we have a Q. Q stands for quad because this was designed when 16-bit was the canonical size. So it's 4 times 16. And it indicates the length is 64 bits or 8 bytes. And you'll see Q for 8 bytes, L for 4 bytes, for long, W for 2 bytes, W stands for word, B for 1 byte. Yeah?
So if I'm making the syntax right, moving the value 42 to the memory address for that RBX.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's exactly what this does. And it treats the value as a 64-bit value, not something smaller. Okay, so this is the sort of basics. And there's one other thing that is probably the most annoying to students part of AT&T syntax, which is how we specify memory addresses that aren't just a value in a register. So this is the most general form. So you can specify first an offset. So a constant number we add when we produce the memory address. And that comes before any parentheses saying we're accessing a value in memory. And you can specify what's sometimes called a base register, which is a register that contains a value to add to the memory address. Then we can have what's sometimes called an index register and a scale. So we take the value in the index register, in this case RCX, multiply it times the scale, which must be 1, 2, 4, or 8, and then add that to form the address. And this is a case where it's easier to see what's going on in Intel syntax, though perhaps less clear what are valid instructions. Yes?
So what exactly does that do?
So what does this do? So the effect of this instruction is to compute the memory address RBX plus RCX times 4 plus 100 and store the value 42 there as a 64-bit value.
Okay, how does it know it's RCX times 4? Is it just kind of always like that?
So the question is, how do we know that we ought to multiply RCX times 4, not RBX times 4? Yeah, it's just always that the second register is the thing we would multiply by.
So you always multiply that?
Yeah. Yes?
So is the formula offset plus base plus index times scale?
Yes, so it's always offset plus base plus index times scale, if you remember those names. Yeah?
Do you have one without the scale? Would it be like the default as 1 or?
So the question is, what happens if I don't have the scale? And yes, it defaults to 1. And I thought I had that on my next slide, but that's the one case I forgot. So you can generally omit every part of this. So if you omit the scale, it defaults to 1. If you you can omit the base register and only specify index and scale, in which case you get next time scale, and so on. You can also omit the value, the offset in front, the constant 100, in which case it defaults to 0. So, any questions on this general syntax? And And if you forget, there's a figure in your book which shows you all the possibilities and what the calculation of the address is. So that's how we specify memory addresses. So it's a little less intuitive than the Intel syntax form. On the other hand, it's all these, every value you can put in the slot is valid pretty much, unlike the Intel form where you can't just write an arbitrary expression as the thing to access in memory because not all of those are actually instructions. So a consequence of the choice of AT&T syntax to always put the destination last is that some instructions do weird things as far as what the order of the operands are. And the big example is subtract. So for subtract, it's the same as Intel syntax as far as whether the destination is the thing you're subtracting from or subtracting by. And it turns out that you always subtract from your destination. So you can read this as subtract RAX from R8, even though that might not be the order you expect those operands to be written. And the same applies for the compare instruction, even though the compare instruction doesn't have anything you might really think is a destination. We'll talk a little more about why this is later. Yes?
So for AT&T, it's R8 minus RAX, and then the result is kept in R8.
Yes. It's R8 minus RAX, and put the result in R8. Yes.
And REX remains
the same, right? And the question is, REX remains unchanged? Yes. Any questions on this? And on test, we will have a reminder on the first page because we don't want you to have to think you need to write this down and then study it just before an exam. That's not what we want you to lose points for. Okay, so I told you that we needed to put a dollar sign in front of constants, and you might say, well, what happens if I don't do that? Is that a syntax error? And no, it isn't. That's how you specify an address constant. So this first add instruction here accesses memory at address hex 1000 and adds that to REX. The second instruction adds the constant hex 1000 to REX. So the dollar sign means you have a constant. If there's no dollar sign and you have a number, it's a memory address. It's the form of our, you know, syntax with parentheses without any register specified. Yes?
Just to clarify what you mean, are you saying that value of REX gets placed at that memory address? Like copy?
No, because the destination's always second. So what this instruction does here is exactly this operation. REX plus memory at that is stored in REX.
Okay, you said the what for
a second? REX plus memory at hex 1000 is stored in REX, is the effect of the first instruction here. Which is, I show you in this pseudocode here. That makes sense, maybe? Yeah. Okay. And the other one adds a constant to REX. You could have also used similar syntax to specify storing it in that place in memory, but it would have to be the second operand. Yeah.
So for subtraction, the destination is the first one? And
for
addition,
no. So question was, for subtraction, the destination is first? No. So the destination's always last. Always, always, always. Even though you might think that this is not the right thing for subtraction, it's still last. And that's why that's very confusing. Okay, so our one slide summary, this is pretty much what you need to know. I want to study this in one slide. So destination, always, always last. Parentheses means a value in memory. We have this displacement-based scale, index scale, which expands to memory at displacement plus base plus index times scale. And you could omit each of the components here. If you omit displacement, it defaults to zero. If you omit base or index, it defaults to zero. If you omit scale, it defaults to one. And a dollar sign means a constant. If there's no dollar sign, it means a value in memory at a particular address. Yes?
So with the parentheses, does that mean the value in memory, but it also says means value in memory?
Yes, so they both mean a value in memory.
Okay, so when are parentheses necessary?
You have to use parentheses if you specify a register of any kind. Otherwise, we mean the actual register. Okay, any questions on AT&T syntax? So we'll see if anything comes up. So on to more review of the actual assembly and not just how we're going to write it down. So as a reminder, or maybe for the first time, I don't know if you've seen all of these, in 64-bit x86, we have these mostly general purpose registers, and I have one other on this picture, which is RIP, I'll talk about later. But these general purpose registers, these registers that you can use with like an add instruction, and there are 64-bit versions like RAX, RBX, RCX. And there are versions for 32-bit, 16-bit, and so on that are just part of the 64-bit register. So RAX is the name for a 64-bit value. EAX is the name for the lower 32 bits. And this is true for all of the registers, even like R14. There's a name for the 32-bit part of it, which is R14D. Yes. So the question is, do you need to memorize these names? You shouldn't. But it would be helpful to know them. We will try to avoid asking questions where it really matters that you've memorized which part of the register, what AX's relationship to AL is or something like that. Okay, so these registers overlap, and there are some rules which will help you in reading assembly, but shouldn't come up in questions in this class. But will help you, like on the Bob Lab, it might make the assembly a little less confusing. So one is that if you set a 32-bit register to a value, that setting that clears the rest of the 64-bit register. So if I move 1 into EAX, it clears all of RAX, even though I'm only setting EAX. So it sets the rest of the RAX to 0. So the resulting value in RAX starts with all zeros, not with all ones in binary. And confusingly, this is not true for 8 or 16-bit registers. As I said, we're not going to test you on this, but this might help you in Bomb Lab reading assembly for the homework to know why some things were being done. Like, why is it accessing EAX when we really care about RAX? And why is it setting AL and then moving that to EAX? Now you know. So that's about overlapping registers, how they work, just to help you read assembly. So I mentioned labels before when I talked about how compiling and linking works. And labels, we said, turn into these placeholders for memory addresses. So labels just represent addresses. And I mean labels in an instruction, in the middle of an instruction, like if we say move from a label to somewhere, like move from a string to a register, the label represents an address. And if we say jump to a label, the label represents an address to jump to. And always represents an address. So you can think of the label standing in for just writing out the address in assembly. So in AT&T syntax, we can specify both, I want to add a value stored at the address specified by a label to RAX, or I want to add the address that corresponds to a label to RAX. And it's just like that this text string gets replaced with the actual memory address written out as a number. And that's generally how labels are going to work in assembly. And you can also do this in Intel syntax, not that you've ever seen offset, I'm guessing, but there's both of these exist in Intel syntax too. You can use a label either as, here's a memory address, and tell the make the machine code say, retrieve the value using this memory address, or use this memory address as an integer. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, apparently not. Oh. And labels work. And you've seen labels for jumps, you just use the bare label. And you could also write jump to a particular address, though you probably have no reason to do that. Okay. So since we're talking about accessing memory, I'm going to briefly talk about LEA. Who's seen LEA before? So people, in my experience, even though it's covered in 2150, are horribly confused about what LEA does. So LEA looks like a move from memory. So it looks like, if we remember our rule, parentheses mean a memory locate accessing a memory location, that it accesses memory. So, but what it does is it does the same thing a move would do, but it stops just before it would access memory and just uses the address it computed. So it stands for load effective address. Effective address is the address we'd access if this were a normal instruction like move. So it computes that effective address, then doesn't do any more work, and uses the effective address to store a value. Stores that in the specified register. So this means, for example, that if I say, if I specify memory at the location specified in RAX plus 4, that address, and load effective address of that into RAX, that's adding 4 to RAX. I compute the memory address, 4 plus RAX, then I'm done. don't do anything with memory, and store it in Rx. So that's another way of writing add the constant 4 to Rx. Any questions on this? I know this is... Yeah?
You would add the constant, like, 4 to get to the next available space in memory, is that correct?
So in assembly, we don't have notions of space because we don't know what types are. But someone decided 4 bytes, which is what, because our memory addresses are all specifying a byte of memory, was the amount to add to RAX. And this will just compute RAX plus 4. And the way you read this is by thinking about accessing memory, but all it's doing is this computation. So it doesn't have to be the case that RAX actually represents a memory address you'd ever want to use. It would still add 4. We just pretend if it were a memory address, what would we do? Yes?
Why would you ever do it this way? Why not just write equivalent arithmetic instructions that do the same thing?
Okay, so the question is, why does anyone use these LEA instructions like this? What's the purpose of this? So we'll talk about one reason a bit later, hopefully. That's a little of an edge case. But the big reason is that the memory address computation is actually very powerful as an arithmetic instruction. So in particular, let's say you want to multiply times 5. How would you do that in assembly? What would be the easiest way, you think? Yeah. So use LEA is the easiest way, it turns out. So how can you do it with LEA?
I can't remember the exact syntax. I think it's, you're using this, it would be LEA Q RAX. RAX comma, RAX plus 4.
RAX comma 4, yes. So basically. Because we have this weird multiply times 4, which happens to make it really convenient to multiply times 5. Or we can use it to multiply times 4 very easily. And that's something that's a whole bunch of arithmetic instructions to do. And this is also convenient for the hardware, because someone in the hardware needs to make something which does the address computation anyways. So clearly, they have all the machinery to do that, and they can reuse it to implement this instruction rather than making something new for a different arithmetic instruction. So if you multiply times 5, many compilers will generate this instruction rather than doing an actual multiply or something else. Similarly, you may be annoyed in x86 assembly that if you want to have 3 registers around rather than moving a value because you're going to add into it and you still want the old value, well, LEA can do that. Gives you a 3 argument add instruction, and you'll see compilers generate that sometimes. So that's why you might see it in assembly you read. And the key thing to remember is it doesn't access memory, even though it's written like a memory access. Any questions on LEA? Yes?
So for this first instruction, could you just not have the base parameter? Does this have a scale be 5?
So the question is, for this instruction, could I just have the scale be 5? So it turns out, no. The only scales which are allowed are going to be 1, 2, 4, and 8. And it's not obvious from anything we've seen why that would be the case, but it just happens that the way the machine code is written for x86 instructions, there's no way to represent any other values. Okay, other questions? Okay, so another thing you probably learned in 2150 is the calling convention. So as a quick review, the 64-bit x86 calling convention on systems we'll use, which are Unix-like, is to use this list of registers for the first 6 arguments, no matter what the size of the arguments is, we just choose the appropriate register size. This is all part of the same 64-bit register. And after the first six arguments, we put arguments on the stack. And the return value is in the register RAX, or some smaller part of it if the return value is in 64 bits. And we don't expect you to memorize this. There's a figure in the book which tells you all this. You don't need to memorize it. But you should be aware of it. In particular, for example, for BombLab, it's really handy to know what the arguments to a function are, especially if you, for example, can find documentation for the function rather than reading the assembly and figuring out what it does. So their calling convention, typical calls to a function, are going to look like moving values into the arguments, running the call instruction, which, as you may remember from 2150, pushes the address of the next instruction on the stack and jumps to the specified location. And in the called function, it's going to move the value it wants to return into the return address register, REX, or some part of it. So any questions about the calling convention? The basic part of the calling convention? Okay. And related to this is how the call and ret instructions in x86 work. So call, as I said, pushes the address of the next instruction onto the stack. Ret pops something from the stack and jumps there. So if you called, ret will jump back to the instruction after the call, assuming that you didn't do anything to the stack in the meanwhile. So another part of our calling convention is what we have to do with registers. So whether we're allowed to change values in registers and have our caller, you know, assume that they changed. And the rule that we'll be using is that there's some registers that functions are not allowed to change. Everything else, you have to assume when you call a function, it's changed. That's values are scribbled over it. So if you had something in R8 and you call a function, it's no longer there. You have to assume. But for these registers, you don't have to assume that. The function is responsible for saving the old values and restoring them before it returns. That's RSP, the stack pointer. So the stack pointer needs to point in the same place when the function returns. The frame pointer, which, did you talk about the frame pointer in 2150? Okay, we won't. But the register that's meant for the frame pointer, which is called RBP, that also functions by convention have to keep the same, and also R12 through R15. This is just a convention, so it's just a choice that we've made about what all functions should do. Yes?
So does the function do that automatically?
So the question is, does the function do that automatically? So the answer is no. Whoever writes the function, the assembly code for the function, needs to do make this happen. And they need to write extra code to do that. For example, they might push R12 to the stack at the beginning of the function and pop it at the end, if they want to use R12 for something else in the middle. Like so. So when you're looking at assembly for the BombLab, you'll commonly see things like this. This is because the compilers are obeying the calling convention about who needs to save what values, who needs to worry about values going away. Any questions about this? Yes?
Why did you push R11 in the previous slide?
The assumption is the other function wants the value of old value of R11 for some reason. I probably should have put a dot, dot, dot above the push. Yeah, that question, why are we pushing R11? Okay, so since no questions on this, here's sort of assembly review question. So I have some code here, and AT&T syntax assembly. Question is, what does it do? What is the resulting values in the registers, or is there something wrong with it? So figure that out. I would recommend writing things down, but you don't have to. And come to an answer and check if your neighbor has the same answer. Yes. That's part of what you should figure out. Well, I think. Okay. So, who has an answer? Who doesn't have an answer? Okay. Less people. So, a majority seem to. So of those of you with an answer, who thinks it's A? How about B? C? D? No. E? E? And something else, F? Okay, so anyone want to defend their answer and say what they think goes on here? No? Okay. So I'll go through how I would figure this out. So this is dealing with the stack. And that's, we know that the push and pop instructions deal with RSP, the stack pointer. And what we have here is first we push the value 1 on the stack. So initially our stack pointer pointed to this 8-byte value. And now it points here after we push 1 to that 8-byte value. And then we push 2. And if you remember from 2150, the stack grows towards lower addresses. So when we run this add instruction, this is where the stack pointer points. So that's this points to that thing. So 0 plus RSP, that's 0 RSP is this 2 value. And because our values are 8 bytes long, that's what the Q stands for, that's 64 bits, 8 plus RSP is the 1 here. So that add instruction is adding 3 to that 1 on the stack and storing the value back there. So we get rid of the 1 and have a 4. And then we pop the first thing on the stack, which is still this 2, into RAX. And we pop the next thing, which is that 4 we just wrote with the add instruction. Yes? So the add instruction, when we get there, the stack pointer points to this 2. So that's 0 plus RSP. 0 plus the stack pointer is the address of that 2. And since each thing on the stack is 8 bytes, the next thing on the stack is at 8 plus RSP, which is the 1, which gets turned into a 4. And part one thing you need to know for this is that the stack, when we push something onto it, we decrement it. We make it go to a smaller address.
So yes. Are all things on the stack 8 bytes, or just?
So the question is, are all things on the stack 8 bytes? So when we use push and pop instructions, it's always 8 bytes for this class.
Okay.
You could move values into memory that are not 8 bytes and use RSP to do it. And you might see assembly do that, but it's not common. Yes?
Is that only because it's a 64-bit machine?
So the question is that only because it's a 64-bit machine? It's related to that. We'll have good reasons why we might want to always use 8 bytes much later in the semester, but largely it's just a choice that's been made about how the stack is used. Yes?
What would you put if you wanted to add that in 2 spaces above?
So the question is, what would I put in the add instruction if I wanted to add to the value 2 spaces above? Meaning this?
Yeah.
Then I would put 16. And I'll add another 8 to the address. Yes?
Before we added everything, was the init RSP box, was that 0 RSP?
Yeah, that was 0. Before any of the push instructions ran, that's what 0 plus RSP was. The rule generally is that RSP points to something that's actually on the stack. And you can figure out how push and pop are supposed to work based on that. Yes?
So does the push instruction always move the RSP down and then push the value onto the stack?
Yes.
It doesn't in that order?
Yes. And this is, so the question is, does push add to RSP, adjust to RSP first, or store to RSP first? And it adjust it first. We won't have you memorize this. This is another thing we'll remind you of on tests. Even though it's important to know. Yes.
What happens if you pop RAX twice?
So what happens if I pop into RAX twice? So if I do, instead of what I have here, if I do pop RAX, pop RAX. So what does anyone want to answer this? So what happens if I had just 2 pop RAXs here? Yeah. We copy it twice. So the first time we would get 2 into RAX, and then we would get 4 into RAX. And RAX can only store one thing, so it's going to have a 4. And who knows what's in RBX in that case?
So, in that case, if pop popping RX twice to produce 4, shouldn't you pop RBX to produce the value that's slightly above 4 with 1 up from that? Because when you pop RX, wouldn't that take that off the stack, making 4 the new RAX?
So, I don't understand your question, what you're asking. So the first time we pop RAX, we're reading a value off the stack into RAX. If we do it again, it's the same thing. We take a value off the stack, put it in RAX. We don't care what RAX had before, doesn't matter to us. So pop always just completely overwrites the register you specify. Doesn't remember whether it was the right thing to store it in. If you like write assembly by hand and have mishmash push and pops, the hardware is not going to help you. Yes? If we were dealing with, sorry.
The base pointer?
So the question is, would the base pointer change during this? And the answer is no. Yeah. So these push and pop instructions are only 8 bytes. On 64-bit x86, there are in fact only 8-byte push and pop instructions. So the question is, this says the stack pointer doesn't have to keep track of how big each thing on the stack is. So push and pop need to add and subtract the correct amount from the stack pointer. But the way they do it is that they know that that push queue instruction that takes a 64-bit register always adds 8, always subtracts 8, and the pop instruction that takes a 64-bit register always adds 8. That's just the rule. They don't need to like have some data structure somewhere to find out. Yes?
So will RAX always be associated with the lowest thing on the stack?
So the question, will RAX always be associated with the lowest thing on the stack? And in this case it is, only because we popped into RAX first. So if we did something else, we have, that wouldn't happen. It's the last in, first out idea of the stack. Okay. Any other questions about this? Or anything else from earlier that this might remind you that you want to ask a question about? Okay, so with that review of assembly, some miscellaneous thing that you might see in Bomb Lab that we're not going to test you on, not going to have you implement. But there's something called RIP you might occasionally see in disassembly. It stands for the instruction pointer, and it's always equal to the address of the next instruction. So it looks like a register, but it's not really a normal register. It's always the address of the next instruction. And you might see it in assembly because you can do something like this, where you load a value into a register that's 500 bytes after the address of the next instruction. And commonly, in assembly files that are generated by compilers, you might see a label before an RIP. And if you remember our rule that labels basically substitute for a memory address, you would think that this takes the memory address of the label and adds it to the address of the next instruction, and that seems very useless. And that would be my first guess as to what this does, but it's not. So as a special case, the assembler and the linker will generate something that's equivalent to just specifying the label, but they'll use a different version of the instruction. In particular, one where the machine code contains the address not stored as a constant number, but stored as the offset from the next instruction. But you wouldn't have a way of knowing this if I didn't tell you, and I'm mentioning this because you might see this sort of thing in reading assembly from Bomb Lab. Not because we're ever going to use it. So any questions on this? Okay, so there's a whole bunch of other stuff in 64-bit x86 that we won't cover today, and most of which we won't cover in this course. So for example, I didn't tell you how to do floating point. There's some instructions that act on multiple values at once using a whole other set of registers we haven't even mentioned. There's something called segmentation, which uses yet another set of registers we haven't mentioned. And there's thousands of instructions, literally thousands, that we will not talk about in this class. I'm just telling you your what you know about assembly is incomplete, and that's fine because we don't want to spend the time teaching you 1,000 instructions. But if you ever need the authoritative source, there's the manual. So Intel has one, AMD has one. It's generally probably not something you want to use because any manual where they need to put combined volumes and that list on it probably is unwieldy. Okay, so that's our review of sort of the mechanics of assembly. And for the rest of today and a little bit probably next time, we'll talk about converting C code to assembly. So you probably had a little practice of this in 2150, but the things that probably haven't seen that much. So so any questions about assembly syntax before I move on, though? Anything like, or what instructions do that we've seen? Okay. So in that case, let's start by thinking about how we convert this C code with an if statement to assembly. So what are we going to use to do this? What are some instructions that would be handy that you might have seen in 2150 or seen used by compilers in BOM lab?
CMP.
CMP. So the compare instruction. Anything else? Jump?
Add.
Okay. So those are probably the instructions you want to use. So how do we organize this to make take advantage of it? What's the general idea? Yeah.
So first you want to set up the gear registers for the comparison for the condition itself.
Okay, so first we need to know we need to do a comparison, so we better do that. Okay. How about then? So we're going to probably do some sort of conditional jump. So how is that going to work out? Where do we put the code for plus equals 10 versus times equals b? Yeah.
Do the conditional jump, and then right after that, you put the else, the a times b, and then. So first you have to compare, and if it doesn't.
Okay. So your idea is that we do the comparison, and if it doesn't match, we have the else right afterwards. So we just fall through to the else if it doesn't match. Is there anything else we need to do? And if it does match, we of course jump to the then. Is there anything else we need to worry about?
Another jump if it goes. So if it goes to the else and then it doesn't, it needs to go around first.
Yeah, so after either the then or the else, we're gonna need to have something to skip over the other part because one of them is gonna have to be first, and we don't want to keep going into the else code. So one way that is handy to think about this, and the reason we talked about GoTo, is that we can sort of write this in C with GoTo. And each of these lines corresponds directly to an assembly instruction, rather than trying to write out the assembly directly. I find this a nice intermediate step for figuring out how do I convert this sort of flow control thing to assembly. So we know there's an assembly, two assembly instructions that do this go to conditionally that I have on the first line, and this handles the case of, you know, shows us that we need to jump after the then case in the way I've organized this in order to not always multiply a times b. Any questions about this transformation? Everyone think they probably could maybe figure it out? So if you're struggling to figure out how to convert it, I would first write this type of C. So then I can convert that C just line by line into assembly. So I do the comparison, and remember the order is wrong. I do the jump, conditional jump, to the after then part, and I have the jump to the after else part. And I have the equivalent instructions for each line. So any questions about what this is doing? Yes.
Explain what the JL instruction does.
So the question is, what's the JL instruction? So as you may or may not remember from 2150, we have a bunch of conditional jump instructions. We'll talk more about them later, which start with a J for jump and talk about the condition, L for less than, LE for less than equal, and so on. And in this class, you will learn much more about how those operate because you'll have to implement them. Any other questions about this example here? Okay. So one thing we just talked about was that conditional jump. And the way conditional jumps work in x86 is there's something called condition code. So there's this special magical register which contains something about the result of the last arithmetic instruction. So every arithmetic instruction sets these condition codes, which store information about what happened during that. Like, was the result zero? Was it negative? Lots of things. And we have these conditional jump instructions like JL, JG, or greater than, so on, which read the condition codes. And they're all named based on what would happen with a subtraction. For example, if the result is zero, that's considered equal, so JE will jump in that case, JLE will jump in that case, JL won't. And you might be saying, wait, we always use compare. Why are you contradicting everything I've learned about how conditional jumps work? We'll get to that later. So for example, if I have negative 10 in REX and 20 in RBX and do the subtraction, I compute RBX minus REX, which is 30, because I can't do arithmetic, but it doesn't affect whether it's positive. But 30, but this is still greater than zero, so that jump branch is not taken. So the JLE foo doesn't go to foo, it just keeps moving on. This makes sense? So the result indicated it was greater, the RBX was greater than RAX. That was what the naming was about. And so the JLE less than or equal, it's not, it's greater than, not taken. So, yeah.
So JLE is looking at the
JLE is looking at the what are called condition codes, which are set by most arithmetic operations. So like subtraction. Yes?
So JLE just knows to look at RBX.
So the question is, JLE just knows to look at RBX? So no. So there's an extra registers which contain information about the last arithmetic operation. And that information, we'll talk more about what the form of that is, but that's about the operation, that's all it reads, and it doesn't actually need to refer to the actual register. So for example, if I were to insert in here a move of 0 into RBX, that would not change the results, because move is not an arithmetic operation. And it would still remember what happened during the last arithmetic operation, because that's stored separately. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
But if you had done an add there, would it change that?
So if I had an add instead of a move, would it change it? The answer is yes. It wouldn't change the answer in this case if it was into RA 0, but yeah, it could change the results in general. Okay, so I promised you that I would clear up your likely confusion about, well, I always learned that the way these conditional jumps work is you do a compare and then you do a jump immediately afterwards, and that's how they work. You have to put those two instructions together. So first, we'll say, what's compare? So compare, the CMP instruction, actually just does a subtraction, except it just forgets to write the result anywhere. So it computes the subtraction result, does everything but write it to a register. And that everything includes setting these condition codes that things like jump look at. So it doesn't matter what RBX actually contains. What matters is that we set the condition codes by the compare operation. We prepared for a conditional jump by running this compare instruction, which we could have also done with a subtract instruction. So it's exactly the same as a subtract instruction, except it doesn't store its results, which is useful because we have these extra condition codes that store something kind of like a result, but not the actual number. There's also another instruction called test, which you may have seen, which does bitwise AND. We'll talk about what that is later in this course. But you most commonly will see something like test RAX RAX. In that case, the value computed is RAX. And it's based on what that would mean for subtraction. So if you see test RAX RAX and you ask for equality, well, if we subtracted and got zero, that would mean equality. So if RAX is zero, then the JE for equality will be true after a test instruction. Which I think is a bit unclear to people. But, I'm mentioning test not because we'll use it, but because you may see it in BOM lab and other real assembly. So it just means compute in this, so that this use of test just means use that as the result. It's most commonly used for comparing to zero, in which case equal will be true after that test instruction. If it's not zero, not equal will be true. Any questions about what compare does here? Okay, so compare lets us do the standard thing where we that you're used to, except the order is wrong because of AT&T syntax. It actually is a subtraction. It follows the same rules that subtraction does. So this asks, is RBX less than or equal to RAX? And the answer is no. And it does that by doing a subtraction and looking at, is the result positive or negative? Any questions on this? If not, we'll move on to another example of converting C to assembly. And that's with loops. So the standard thing, I'm going to start with the simplest kind of loop, which is a do-while loop. You probably don't use them very much, but I'm starting with them because they're the simplest to convert to assembly. And I'm going to use the same steps I talked about before, which is I'm going to start by writing C with GoTo. And what I need to do is when X is greater than zero, I want to go back to the beginning of the loop. So that's what I'm going to write. I'm going to have a label for the start of the loop, and I'm going to have go to if x is greater than zero. Well, that's what I can convert this loop into. And then this is fairly straightforward to convert to assembly, just line by line. And that go to converts to a compare followed by a conditional jump. So this conversion, give you some time to look at it. Any questions about it? Make sense? Feel like you could do this following those two steps, going to C with GoTo first and then this? Okay. So we can do a little bit better than this. So in particular, we don't actually need the compare instruction. That I can just remove the compare instruction. Because that subtraction happens to be the same as comparing 1 to RBX before you subtract it, as far as the condition codes. Yes?
Is there a case where you don't want to get rid of the compare instruction?
So the question is, would I not want to get rid of this compare instruction for any reason? Basically, no. There is a slight difference in the effect when values wrap around. But otherwise, basically no. And compilers will, in fact, generate the second version here because they know this. By hand, I completely understand if you generate the first version because it's what the most logical translation is.
So it's literally only in the syntax to make it more logical than writing.
So the question is, why do we have the compare instruction if I can always just use subtractions? So not all cases are going to have some value where the result of the subtraction actually tells you what you need to know. So in this case, for example, it only worked because we actually care about it being greater than zero. If we cared about it being like less than 100, it wouldn't tell us the right thing, right? That subtraction wouldn't be equivalent to a comparison that mattered to us. In particular, whether the result was negative or zero wouldn't tell us what we needed to know. Yes? So the conditional jump, so as I said, they're named based on subtraction. So for 1 minus 1, if you, they're named based on the compare operator, which is really subtraction. So compare 1 and 1, does 1 minus 1 equal 0? So that's what we expect for equality. And so that means that JGE, when you're asking it if values were equal, it's saying, well, what's the result of the last thing? 0. Because that's what the compare instruction would do if two equal values were compared.
Why isn't checking the whole RBX is greater than
equal? So that's what you would say if I wrote compare one RBX above the subtract. That's what you say that would be doing. And that's why I wrote it that way. They're equivalent things, and you could say, you could write either way. I'm just giving the simplest interpretation based on this idea that subtract is the same as comparison without storing the results that's computed. So, other questions on this? So I know. So the key thing, which is a bit subtle, is that you can think of the jump conditional jump instructions as asking about comparing the value to zero for the most part. So jump equal means, was the result of the last thing zero? Because that's what comparing two equal values does, because comparing subtracts internally. If it's greater than, was the subtracted from value, was the value positive? Because when you compare two values, it subtracts then. If it's positive, the first value was greater. Yes?
So you're saying the subtract instruction does the computation, then sets the condition codes based on the result, and then stores the result?
So the question is, the subtract instruction does the computation, sets the condition codes, and stores the result.
In that order.
You can think of it in that order. Whether they actually happen in that order or not, there's no way to tell. Because you don't run an instruction in the middle of the subtract instruction. Like, it happens as if all one at a time. And much later in the semester, we'll talk about when things actually happen. And it's not so obvious. Yeah. So it's the only case. So it's only the case if you have both. If you had a subtraction instead of an add, is your question. So if I had, instead of this subtraction, if I had this add, that would also work because it's the same result. If I had an operation where the result didn't tell me what I needed to know, like the compare that we wanted to replace was something like comp q 100, I'd be out of luck without some additional work. Because it doesn't, you know, I don't have anything which is actually telling me based on the result being related to zero in some way, whether I want to go on with the loop or not. Other questions on this? Okay, so yeah, so yes, yeah, so as I said, it's the result that matters. So for example, if I compute a result of zero, then JE says true. So it doesn't matter if I do it with an add. And it doesn't matter whether I use the compare instructions or not. And the other thing is that it's arithmetic operations. So if I compute a result of zero, and then do something that isn't arithmetic, like a move, that doesn't change anything. Should you do this? Probably not, but it won't change anything. And this brings me to a minor point. So most instructions that compute something set condition codes. And there's some instructions we talked about which only set condition codes. And there are a bunch of instructions which don't change condition codes. And move, which obviously doesn't do a computation, except of addresses, is an obvious one. And also control flow instructions don't change the condition codes generally. There's one notable other exception, which is LEA. And this is another reason why you might want to use LEA, or not use LEA. Okay. So any questions about condition codes in general? We'll talk more about condition codes when we're implementing our processor, but we'll be in a little bit and later. But questions about this view of condition codes so far, like how we use them, how they're affected by other instructions, so on. Okay. So in our last few minutes, here's an exercise with what we learned. And you can compare your results with your neighbor rather than just checking. Okay, so before we finish up, who has an answer? I know not all of you may be done looking at this. Thinks it's A. Okay, B, C, D, E, F. Okay, so not agreement. So let's just step through this, starting with the beginning of the loop. So initially, RBX is 2. Then we do our first iteration of the loop, and we set RBX to 4. We compare it to 3, but that doesn't matter, because we subtract immediately afterwards, and that sets the condition codes the conditional jump uses. So I can just ignore that compare instruction. And then I subtract 1 from RAX. So RAX was 3. And now RAX is 2. And the result of that subtraction is greater than 0, meaning that RAX was greater than 1. So we do another iteration of the loop. So then we set RBX to 8, and we subtract 1 from RAX, getting 1. And the result of that is greater than 0, meaning RAX was original before the subtraction, greater than 1, which means that it's greater than, so we do yet another iteration of the loop, assuming, and we get RBX equals 16. And then finally, RAX is 0, meaning the result of the subtraction said it wasn't greater than the thing we were subtracting from it. So jump greater than won't happen, so we finish the loop.